Welcome to this week's edition of the Aquila Report and Weekly Review. This is Dominic Aquila, along with Paul Harrell. I'll bring you the top 10 articles that were read by the Aquila Report readers last week. Today is Monday, March 25, so it was all the week before. And those articles that were posted on the Aquila Report now have been registered, and we have the top 10 that you, as the Aquila Report readers, read. And we're so delighted to be able to have you. So this is an opportunity for Paul Harrell, myself, to come to you with the top 10 articles that were read and that will be a part of the newsletter that will go out tomorrow. And we have thousands of people who have signed up for that. So we're really glad that you're part of that. And these top 10 articles will be presented hyperlinks. All you do is click on them. Paul and I will just go through them fairly quickly to give you a sense, a tease, what's coming up this week. We have, I think, very good list of articles, a wide variety, and it's interesting always to see how the Aquila Report, as discerning as they are, choose that just by what they read. So, Paul, as I've already said, I think these are good sort of broad range. Sometimes we get these a theme going here. I'm not sure if there's a theme. Maybe we'll find one as we go through here.
Yeah, you never know. It's a probable outcome at this point.
That's right. I didn't see anything. I'm going to use the word real quick here and early on. No slippery slope things that I did see.
Find it.
Although there's one that might happen. So we'll come back to that. Okay. Well, why don't you read the top 10, 10 through 6. I'll read 5 through 1, and then we'll get off on our discussion.
That sounds good. Number 10 last week, Trevin Wax, rumblings of revival among Gen Z, ? Then we have Kevin DeYoung, anti-fragile faith, coming number 9. Number 8 last week, woeful woke wonders weakening the West by Bill Muhlenberg. Love the alliteration there. Coming in at number 7, we've got What God Is Jordan Peterson Wrestling With? This written by Aaron M. Wren. And number 6, Charles Baik, or how do you say it? How do you pronounce
Baik.
It?
Baik.
Mm-hmm. Forgive my ignorance, Charles Baik. I am one of the 85% who did not persist in pastoral ministry.
Okay, then number 5 is by Scott Yenor, Phyllis Schlafly's Tragic Failure. Number 4 is by Brad Isbell, Against Requiring Background Checks. It has something to do with internal to the PCA, which we'll get to then. Number 3, It Eventually Comes to This by Bethel McGrew. Then number 2, Encouragement for Those Who Aren't Resting on the Sabbath by Guy Waters. And then number 1 is religious movement. No, it's a religious movement, not a disease, by D.G. Hart. And that's where we start in this. He says historians may be changing the way they look at contemporary evangelicalism. And so in this, Doug Hart begins by saying calls for amnesty among those who defended and implemented the protocols of the COVID-19 pandemic are hardly news. Emily Oster was the first to call for clemency for advocates of government's restrictive measures, and she argued that many officials simply did not have sufficient knowledge for a better outcome. Since then, Gavin Newsom, governor of California, and Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, have also pled for understanding. All right. A similar call has also surfaced among evangelical scholars for assessing born-again Protestants who voted for Donald Trump. And so, probably the comparing those who took the restrictive implementations of COVID-19 now with those who voted Trump, I guess. But for almost 8 years, evangelical historians have diagnosed white evangelicals as carriers of the MAGA bug. Of course, let's make America great again initials, MAGA. From there, they have explained the medical histories of evangelicals and found long-term evidence of disease. He refers also here to John Fee, recently published back on his back on this assessment. He complains that the diagnosis and prescribed treatment were flawed. He also confesses that he was a part of the rush to misdiagnose. His book, Believe Me, was one of the first to acclaim that evangelicals had tested positive for the Trump virus. Now the Messiah University historian is having second thoughts. So what is leading to this is, as Hart goes through and just assesses, you know, how do you go about assessing a movement or an issue that's part of history? And basically, you know, you get the facts and hopefully you're listening carefully to those who are involved in these kinds of things. And so Fee's mea culpa, Hart says, may signal a return to viewing evangelicalism not as a disease, but a religious movement. Everyone understands that scientists, both natural and humanistic, interpret evidence, whether viruses, presidents, or evangelists. Historians evaluate data as much as public health experts. Still, the best historical judgments do not change with the headlines. A virus may require government to respond, but Protestants from the past do not. The 1969 moon landing did not require historians of Puritanism to reconsider John Winthrop's 1630 arrival in Boston. So, of course, it being a little ludicrous at that point. Anyway, for the past 7 years, however, the historical profession has operated as if current events do alter understanding of the past. In the disorienting summer of 2020, the University of Pennsylvania removed the statue of George Whitefield, a good friend of the university's founder, Benjamin Franklin. And in 1919, at the statue's unveiling, a group of New York City Methodist alumni delighted in their efforts to construct a Whitefield movement monument that recognized his role in the university's beginning. As late as 2013, Whitefield's support was the chief way the institution remembered him. Penn Today, a year ahead of the tricentennial of Whitefield's birthday, featured the evangelist's labors for higher education in addition to Penn. He had assisted Princeton and Dartmouth. So the point that Hart making there is, here is someone like Whitefield who made had such an impact during the what would be called the First Great Awakening, and to the point where he was had some part in the establishment of the University of Pennsylvania, along with something to do with Princeton and Dartmouth and probably some others if we probably look back on it. But now that was in 2013 when they honored him. And then by 2020, the university removed Whitefield's statue because of all the things that were happening. Of course, 2020 was not only the time for COVID, but also the BLM movement and so much more.
You mean the summer of love.
That's right. The summer of love while everything was burning. So John Fee's reminder of historians' proper task is clearly welcome. So he's glad that there's a mea culpa and repentance, but it may be too little too late. Fee's own training did not prevent him from writing what evangelical Trump voters had traded their Christian witness for a mess of political pottage and a few federal judges. The rush to judge wicked men from Nixon to Clinton and their supporters is a persistent temptation to scholars who would be journalists. So in other words, he says, history, if you're going to be a historian, you've got to take a step back. You've got to let it simmer. You let the dust has to settle. And then you have time to go back and read the documents with a clear-eyed approach to history, not caught up in the histrionics of the moment. And so that's the reason that so much happened. And of course, Paul, articles from going all the way back to when Trump was running, we've seen, you know, the back and forth in the evangelical world. And that people couldn't believe, like in 2016, that 80% of those who were self-identified as evangelicals voted for Trump. And it was just, you know, causing all sorts of distress. Like you said, the MAGA disease was taking place. So now time has changed a little bit to reflect And that's good. So basically, this article is a sort of a little jab in the eye, but it's also basically saying, if you're going to be historical and see a trend, take your time and let the dust settle, do your research, and let so that we see what the outcome is. There's going to be another article that comes up with the Trevin Waxman fact number 10, which he talks about, hey, you know, maybe we've not judged Gen Z correctly, and maybe we need to now a little bit more dust is settling on that, and we'll see. Maybe there's a revival taking place here. Here are some symptoms that we can look at. So, Paul, it's a remembrance that sometimes we can speak too quickly. And now, if you're a journalist, you make assessments quickly. But if you're a historian, there's certain principles you need to follow.
I mean, you know, no doubt about that. I think at this point, I mean, you know, I'm more of a journalist. I am a journalist. I'm certainly not a historian. So, yes, we do make judgments really, really quick. That's certainly part of it. But, you know, when it comes to the evangelical support of Donald Trump, I think it's at this point. I mean, I didn't think it was anything to apologize for back then. It's certainly right. Nothing to apologize for now, just considering where things are. Nobody, and, you know, the knee jerk reaction, and a lot of people were saying, oh, you know, these Christians are being they're succumbing to idolatry and they're worshiping Donald Trump. And while there may be some of those out there that are, you know, angry and red pilled and maybe worship Trump, I just don't think that's a general trend among Christians. Personally, I never actually saw it. I heard people warning about it, but I never actually saw it. I think people were just using the rights that they still have left. In this case, you know, Christians still have the right to vote in this country, and they were looking at the situation and. They were looking at one party that essentially, you know, I don't know if I want to get into this, but I mean, it was just interesting the moral high ground that people were taking because of Trump's infidelity or what have you. And yet you had the other side that was, you know, basically saying, look, abortion, it's an amazing thing and you should all go out and try it. You know, Trump wasn't telling everybody to go cheat on their wives. So I'm one of these guys, Donnelly, that would love the moral equivalency argument. I would revel in it. I'm willing to have that debate, but I digress.
Well, and it's happening because with more time passing, that on most situations, there is always a revision that's going on because, oh, we didn't notice this. Oh, we didn't know that. So, you know, it happens. You know, he mentions, you know, from Nixon to Clinton, you know, both of those presidencies have now gone through or are going through some revisionist. His, mm-hmm. it, not revisionism in the sense of telling a different lie, but we're getting more information. Now we're looking at the documents and we're seeing the impacts and you have more data to be able to.
You know, on the Nixon front, this. I don't, you know, I mean, there's documents out there now that suggest that Nixon was set up by the intel community, and which is extremely familiar considering Trump was just framed as a traitor for the last, you know, 4 years of his presidency. Yeah. So anyway.
Right. All right. Well, so the point is we if we're going to make assessments, don't claim a journal historian hat. Wear your journalist hat, right? And so even then, you should probably be careful in what you're saying. But it's a helpful reminder from Doug Hart. Okay, number two is a little bit different. It was interesting that this would be number two. I'm glad it is because it was so good. Encouragement for those who aren't resting on the Sabbath, and this is by Guy Prentice, and it's very brief. That printed out of Crossway, out of a book, the Sabbath as Rest, is a book that Dr. Waters has written. He says basically very, it's almost like a devotional thing, but just very pithy, very good. If I were to be in a position to speak to someone who is not observing the Sabbath, I think there might be three things that I want to share. Okay, and he says, first is that Sabbath isn't a tradition just observed by the church. It's something that God has given us in his word. He also says that the second thing I would want to share with them is the blessing of this day that they need this day, why they need this day. And then number three, then the third thing is I want to share with them is that Sabbath is an opportunity for a blessing to others, to be a fellowship with the people of God, as well as to encourage them. So very simple, but yet in those three statements, he, you know, says quite a bit, and, you know, for us to ponder. And it gives you also a sense of why you might want to get his book, The Sabbath as Rest, is the title of the book that he gives to us. And one of the things that I do enjoy him saying is that God did not make us to run 24/7. We're not perpetual energy machines. God did make us to work, but he also made us to worship and to enjoy the rest of being in his presence. So a helpful reminder that God didn't make a mistake in how he organized us and the world in which we're living.
And I'm just assuming that one of the reasons this made number two is because of the exceptions that sometimes people take, you know, when they of the Westminster Confession, right, when they go before a particular presbytery. Mm-hmm. The Sabbath is a common one. Is that not correct, Dominic?
It's number one. And we saw that from the article of the assessment, the statistical assessment that Matthew Lee, we had him a couple of weeks ago, and that very popular article. So if you want to go back and look at that, that's a good point that you're making, Matt Lee's view on exceptionalism. And it's all statistically worked out. So we don't have to, you know, take a stab in the dark. We have the numbers. And the point you were making on that, though, is that there's misunderstanding when people take that exception.
Oh yeah, I think that's why mm-hmm. there's such interest, and that's why it was number two on the list, because people want to know.
That's right, and I think that we can't get away from it. People know that there's something. I mean, it's intuitive, it's built into us, but it's also revealed in Scripture. So, very great, wonderful reminder from Dr. Waters. Okay, number three is from Bethel McGrew. It eventually comes to this. And what is the this here? A prominent LGBTQ activist now faces blowback from the left. And Bethel is saying here, 12 years ago, a college student named Matthew Vines exploded into the faith and culture scene with an hour-long lecture, The Gay Debate, The Bible, and Homosexuality. And this viral speech was delivered to his home church in Wichita, Kansas, presenting a revisionist case for affirming the goodness of same-sex romance. Vines had taken 2 years out of his Harvard study to research the presentation, which doubled as a personal testimony about growing up the same-sex attracted in an evangelical home. And he quickly sort of hit the scene, and this is 12 years ago, so that puts it around 2012, and that's about the time that we see things beginning to shift and change in the evangelical world. And Paul, as you and I've said, it sort of came big time into the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA, as well as some other churches as well, in 2018, when Revoice exploded on the scene and all the debates that came out of that. So the criticism, though, was sparked by a new statement on the Reformation Project, which is a website that is run by Matthew Vines, titled Reform versus Revolution. And the statement is crafted to draw a sharp distinction between affirming theology and queer theology. In an embedded conference lecture delivered last fall, Vines warns that the goals of the queer theorist are at odds with the goals of the Reformation Project. He said, we don't need to queer the Bible, he says. We just need to interpret it more accurately and faithfully, and we don't need to then queer the church, where the Reformation Project argues for normalizing the LGBTQ people in the church. Queer theorists want to do away with sexual norms altogether. And so that's the reason the title in the book is, it comes to this, that now these facing blowback from the left, that is those who want to be more extreme in their understanding and view of what needs to be in the church. So it goes on like this. It's not that the modern modernist liberals are wrong about objective truth, the postmodern insanity. It's not that Vines is wrong to be shocked and disgusted by all the quotes he reads out. It's just that it simply won't do to see sexual progressivism as a train that was nicely chugging along on the LGB, and stop there, LGB track, until it inexplicably veered off on the TQ plus track. And of course, T is for transgenderism, Q is for queer, to borrow the metaphor from Douglas Murray. So any good investigator at the scene of a crash would want to ask questions about what happened before the train left the station. Questions like, was gay marriage really the gently inclusive, minimally demanding social reformation Sullivan and Vines think it was, or was it a revolution in itself? And when queer theologians like Billy Horde tell Vines they should all have basically the same goal, is that not, in a sense, that which is right? Vines claims to be deeply concerned about preserving truth, but the truth is that his own project began with a lie, not only about the law written on scripture, but also the law written on our hearts and our bodies. So it's interesting that the other side now, so to speak, the progressive side, has opened Pandora's box, has opened a doorway that we're not sure where it's going, but all of a sudden those that were trying to bring, quote, the reform in the church now do have to live with the revolution that is taking place.
I just think it's incredible that we can say the word queer again. There was a time where you couldn't say that word, and now you can again. An observation.
No, and you know, as I read it, I said, "Well, I better stop and explain." I said, "No, that's the language they're using. In fact, it's in the LGBTQ."
Yeah.
It's there. It'll become the Q word eventually.
It'll become a word that we're not allowed to use.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's their word, Dominic.
No, I agree. And and they can use it. So then for the license is there, and that's unfortunate. And by the way, as you and I have talked about before, we might as well, while we're talking about our little initialed acronyms, we have the minor attracted people, MAP. And pretty soon we're going to probably be able to use that P to mean pedophile, and it will be okay.
That's
right. But right now it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay, because that has all sorts of other meanings to it. So you have.
We're missing is a new gay musical genre where they can sing or yodel. I don't know what would happen, you know, and use the Q word, right? And then we won't be able to use it.
Exactly. If it comes from someone else. Okay. Well, that's number three. So eventually you get blowback from the left. And that happens any movement. By the way, that's part of the points that Hart was making about that. If you do jump into something immediately and just to make an evaluation, you can't always see it. But now we've had enough time that passed that all of a sudden you see that there's a trend line that is coming about. And so you have to go back and look, what were the documents like? What was the speech like? What were the ideas and notions and definitions? And man, we're seeing the thing come out and be exposed. Okay, number four is by Brad Isbell from PresbyCast. And the title is Against Requiring Background Checks. He says the presbytery would set a dangerous precedent with a shall being included in its Book of Church Order. And so this deals specifically with something that's before the upcoming, in June of 2024, General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in America. He says overtures to the 53rd General Assembly that in America that would require with a shall to purchase the background checks for all officer and ministerial candidates violate the principle of a church's property. It's its own and cannot be taken by a higher court agency or a committee of the church. So now that sounds like this is a very narrow understanding of the way in which the PCA is actually formed, that we make a distinction. And Brad raises it here in this article between the spiritual connection that we have in the PCA between the local church, the presbytery, and the General Assembly, and the civil connection. So there is a spiritual connection, ecclesiastical, in which we bind ourselves by a common understanding of love and commitment to one another. But there's a distinctive civil connection that doesn't exist, so that the local church owns its own property and governs its own operations internally, and it's civilly self-incorporated. Then the presbytery is the same. It is an ecclesiastical body, but at the same time, it is incorporated as its own civil entity. And then the General Assembly itself the same way. So with that as the backdrop, what Brad is saying here is that the this proposed overture to the BCO, it wants to add a phrase that deals with background checks, which probably everyone would agree generally with that principle, but it says it would require, that is, a shall is used. And so that's where the problem comes in. So if it says it is suggested, recommended, it probably won't be a problem unless there's something else in the wording that might be problematic. But the shall is problematic. And he says many PCA churches incurred great financial loss to come into the denomination from the Presbyterian Church U.S., that is, in the old Southern Presbyterian Church from which the PCA came, because of claims to local church property by the denomination and its presbyteries. So churches lost buildings, ministers lost pensions, or churches paid huge sums to keep what they already rightly owned. So written into the constitution of the PCA is this distinction I just mentioned between our connectionalism being spiritual and ecclesiastical, but not civil in its authority. So what he's arguing for is that we should not make anything mandatory from the top down. Background checks have great utility, he says. Nearly every church and court will deem it wise to use them. Many already do. Churches ought to use them, but asking, encouraging, and even imploring churches and courts to use them is the most the General Assembly, the PCA, can do or should do, because of the property of a church is its own. So local churches may require officers or those working with children to undergo background checks. You can do it in the local body, but this is a local church spending its own money, not being required to do so by someone that's not a part of that corporate body. It may even be proper for presbyteries to require candidates to undergo it, but again, it's within that own civil domain. So writing such provisions into the PCA Constitution would set a dangerous precedent and would undermine the freedom and rights of our local churches. So that's just a warning that a shall may get in the way, and we need to be careful about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Brad is just advocating for the structure here to remain decentralized, you know, and not as centralized. And I think it's in very good. It really hadn't even crossed my mind. General Assembly to require lower courts or churches to dispose of their property up potentially against their will.
Can't do it.
Yeah.
And now we see the phrase that I use to that I tend to use in this is that there is a historic generic view of Presbyterianism that everyone believes is inherent. And when you hear the word Presbyterian, that there is a connectional system. And so they tend to tie it connectionally, both spiritually and ecclesiastically and civilly. Now, civilly means more that how you deal with what's yours, the possessions you have, the property you have, the assets you have, and that the way the PCA purposely chose to organize itself. And most of this is enshrined mainly in the Book of Church Order, Chapter 25, which is unique to the PCA as a Presbyterian body, so that it makes it absolutely clear that each of the three courts, the session, presbytery, and General Assembly, are civilly and separately incorporated, and they handle those things that are part of that civil demand, so that we cannot, the lower higher court can't tax and mandate that you that a local church or a lower court have to do certain things that is civil. Now, in terms of the spiritual, yeah, there are quite a few rules that we can hold people to that are of that nature. So he's just calling that attention. So it's a very unique distinction that the PCA has if the, apart from the generic and historic understanding of Presbyterian connectionalism. So, okay, number five, Phyllis Schlafly's Tragic Failure by Scott Yenon. And it says, we remember Phyllis Schlafly, at least in the 70s and 80s, that she was the leader. She just sort of arose out of the Midwest. She was from Illinois. And when during the presidency of President Carter, Jimmy Carter, that he proposed and there was passed by the two houses of Congress by their vote necessary and sent down to the states. So you need three quarters of the states. That would have been 38 states to needed to approve an amendment. It was called the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA. Schlafly rejects the Who Stole Feminism gambit when asked in her life whether feminism made any positive contributions to American life. Schlafly only saw debits. No, I think it made women unhappy. It made them believe that that we still live in a discriminatory, non-just society, and that they should look to government to solve their problems. To read Schlafly's work, as I have in the past year, according to the author, is to hear a nary a nice thing about feminism. So with her background in this area, she held out. And so I think we got up to like 35, 36 states. So you only needed like two or three more to have approved it, and it never came. In fact, then later on, and you're supposed to have, the rule was, or the sense was that it had to be passed within 7 years, and the Congress kept extending the time. And in fact, the more they extended time, then there were other states that rethought that and rescinded their prior action. And so there was going to be debate as, if you've already approved it, can you rescind it before it's finally approved? So that was going to sort of be the next big, you know, judicial debate as to can you rescind something before it is finalized? And so they never had to answer that question because finally the last renewal of date extension for voting ceased and the ERA was not adopted. So the point of the author here, Yenon, is that she lost because the things that were in the ERA by different means, just legislation, Supreme Court actions, and so forth, have sort of been accomplished. So it ends with conservatives pine for Schlafly tamer than the one who existed. Her career stood for honoring motherhood, not care or service or even life. Her tragic failure reveals more about the America than her shortcomings, and it suggests that a revived family culture must go further back in order to go forward. So in other words, that which people were fighting against, probably you need to go back in history. There's that historical lore again. Let's go back and see that and see where changes have made. And so her failure, according to the article, to sort of spin off of that, was that that old view or that historical view or at least perceived view is no longer present. And so without the ERA, much of what the ERA was talking about has come forward. And so there was a tragic failure. So that's an interesting way to look at history, isn't it, Paul?
It really is. And, you know, you have feminism that just kept advancing and, you know, makes all of these, you know, supposed progress. And then you get to, you know, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who refuses to identify what a woman is, which basically undercuts all of the gains feminism have made. It really just goes to show you that the idol, I think, that is feminism, changes the bargain, changes the deal, mm-hmm. is, you know, basically turns it all on its face. So
now the point that probably should make, Paul, is then if we if the through process of legislation and just change in the culture's mindset took place, and there is, quote, no ERA, then what the argument, that last sentence that we have in that article, and the article says that basically maybe it can be revived in the way that it catches the richness of what is was perceived to be a very dominant and good thing.
Yeah, it says her tragic failure reveals more about America than her shortcomings, and it suggests that a revived family culture must go further back in order to go forward. So a different analogy, a different issue would be there's a lot of people disturbed about transgenderism, a lot of people disturbed about, you know, mutilating children and calling it healthcare. But then if you say, hey, I don't think gay marriage should be legalized, they say, whoa, 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 that's just two men. What are you doing? And they don't get that you've got to go further back. If you want to stop where we are now, then you need to start embracing God's definitions of things and his standards for things and his order for society. Then, you know, and a lot of people still aren't there yet, you know.
No, that's exactly right. Remember, we've had this discussion in this way, that if you describe where the Roman Empire was in the early church in the first century, describe it culturally and ethically, in terms of the culture that was present at the time and how people felt about relationships and sexuality and things like, and religion, and then go 300 years later, you'll see that it changed, and it changed internally as a culture without there being any legislation, any law, because Rome was still in control, and it became more and more distinctively Christianized. So the Romanized view, culture emphasis, was overwhelmed by the Christianized. And so it's possible for there to be a resurgency. And some folks are arguing that that is possible, that we've Romanized so much that maybe it's time to think, how can the church and believers live out the salty imperatives of the gospel such that the Christianized influence comes and we don't have to do it through legislative and legal means, but by transforming culture.
And having babies.
And having babies, exactly. Right. And so, and that goes back to what we're going to see in number 10 with the, what's happening with Gen Z. They're a little bit differently. We would expect them to have turned out a little bit differently than they are. Now we're seeing some things again, just glimmer of light. You know, we can't make a whole prognostication on it. Okay. Next one is, by Charles Bike, I am one of the 85% who did not persist in pastoral ministry. And so Charles, in this thing, saw numerous scholarly works, broadcast and leadership materials reference a well-known Duke study that stated 85% of seminary graduates leave the pastoral ministry within 5 years of completing their studies. But rarely do we hear the first hand from one of these individuals. He says, well, I'm one of the 85% who did not persist in pastoral ministry. By the way, just to deal with that, there were a variety of reasons given in that study. And by the way, that wasn't the only study done. Other groups have done it in the past. I haven't seen anything more recent than this Duke study, but there were some before. So anywhere, whether it was always as high as 85% or not, I'm not really sure, but it has been certified through good research over the years, over the decades, that if the possibility of a man falling out of pastoral ministry and quitting being a pastor will happen most likely within the first 5 years of his ministry. That's the highest fallout rate, and then it decreases after that. So you make it into the sixth, seventh, eighth, you still may fall out, but the percentages are in your favor. But the first 5 years are really difficult. So Charles is speaking about his own experience, and it's, you know, something to reflect on, and he gives some good statements about it, what was happening in him, the internal matters, you know, having to reconnect with himself and his feelings and his relationship with Jesus, his connection with the church, his family. I mean, he speaks very passionately, very carefully yet carefully about what he has gone through and things that, you know, the causes, he almost goes through them so naturally over the first 5 years without knowing that he was a case study in the making, without knowing he was a case study. And so anyway, we'll leave it to you to do this, maybe just to giving the caution that we who are in the church maybe realize that, you know, this, I preached a sermon here recently that I used this opening phrase, sort of two opposing phrases. One is that that GE in the 60s had a commercial in which they had this as their tagline: people are our most important business. And I always thought, I was a fairly young Christian at the time, and as I thought about it, that should be the church's tagline. You know, people are our most important business, with reference to who we're touching and so forth. And then second, but the other side is that the pastor, like maybe Charles here would agree with this, is that ministry would be a lot more fun if we didn't have to deal with people. And so but that is the reality. It is people centric in terms of dealing with their hurts, their pains, their suffering, identifying with their joys. You know, they have the birth of a baby, then within a year, maybe a spouse dies or a grandparent dies, or something is happening all the time. And so you just need to realize the emotional toll if you're not really set ready for all of those distinctions. Not all of it is just preaching the, you know, sermon that's going to create the next great awakening. So, Paul, it's just something that all of us need to be careful about with reference to,
you know, as somebody who's, you know, not an elder and not in that world. But I can still imagine that, you know, our identity as all believers is in Christ, right? That's who we are.
Right.
And I can imagine that, you know, maybe being a minister of the gospel as a profession can maybe replace who you are in Christ. You know, I bet that's a temptation. I'm assuming that's correct. And, you know, but that's not who you are. That's not what defines you, even though it is a profession, right, about the gospel and ministering, you know. You know, it still doesn't need to define who you are, is what I'm trying to say.
And by the way, I just want to do, we usually refer to Jeremiah as the weeping prophet. And there is a place, one passage that I've always sort of clobbed onto because appreciate the reality that of what Jeremiah went through in chapter 20, where he actually had the audacity to, you know, to say to God, you know, you deceived me. When you called me, you deceived me. And I said, you know, I don't think in my worst day I've ever said that about God. Maybe I thought it and I'm not owning up to it, but he was saying it and there it is in the scripture. And he sort of rails at God a little bit. He says, you know, I'm doing what you told me to do, and these folks aren't listening. And so he says, so I'm just going to hang it up. And he concludes himself in by saying, but when I thought about doing it, I just couldn't do it. And why? He says, because your word is within me as a burning fire, and I can't give it up. So it's not, so there has to be that. Now, it doesn't mean there wasn't burning fire here. It's just that, that's what Jeremiah went through, but it was deep and it was emotional and it was real. And anyway, I think people read us and we can work to pray. Remember to pray for our pastors and church leaders and others in our ministry and other parts of the church's life as well. Okay, so let me see. What we have next in is from Aaron Wren. What is Jordan Peterson wrestling with? Of course, Jordan Peterson knows something about reaching people in our age that the church can learn from. And he just says, while he would see Jordan Peterson as basically a new age spiritualized person and spiritualizer, the way he communicates some of the moral and personal issues are things that you know, we can learn from, and this is Aaron Wren's point. Now, he's not advocating that he become the model for Christian living, but he's able to pick up some things that cause, why do people listen to him? In fact, he says that he went to hear him. He wrote a book just recently, and Aaron went to hear him speak. He says he's doing Peterson's doing a national tour on the theme of wrestling with God, which I attended last week in Indianapolis. It sold out, 2,500 seat auditorium with a minimum ticket price of $100. And so he's still a big draw, because the thought was that maybe he'd sort of hit his high watermarks back in the late teens of this century. And so he, you know, captures some of the things. What is it that he's still able to connect with in these people who are listening to him? And he talks about, for example, you're morally obligated to do remarkable things. Why? Well, partly because life is so difficult and challenging that unless you give it everything you have, the chances are very high that it will embitter you. And then you'll be a force of darkness. That's not good. Also, the fact that life is short, can be brutal, can terrify you into hiding. But you can flip that on its head and understand that since you're all in, you might as well take the adventurous risks. And that is a very good thing to understand. So he goes on to say, if you're attempting to say that you believe what you believe to be true and attempting to act on the matter in a manner that you think is most appropriate, that's genuinely you. If you're trying to live the truth, you have the force of reality behind you, and that seems to be a good deal, and you have the reality and the adventure. So why is that a moral obligation? Well, if you hide and you don't let that what's inside of you out, and you don't bring it into the world, what you could bring, is cynical and bitter. Not only will you not add to the world what you could add, but you'll start being jealous of people who are competent and doing well and work to destroy them. That pathway is the pathway to hell. And of course, he later on, Wren says he doesn't use the word hell as a place as the scripture defines it, but just as a difficult experience. So he says we can find some things, learns, and he points out a few of these, and I like you read the article to see what they are. And so, Paul, it's something, I guess, out of someone who is speaking strongly and with a, seems like a strong moral tone, but as Aaron Wren says, he's probably just a nice, new age, deeply spiritualized individual, but definitely not a Christian.
No, he's not. And, you know, people are praying to that end for him, as well as other people. But yeah, and he's not yet. You know, some people said he's not far from the kingdom, some of the things he said. But yeah, I would definitely put him in that new age category. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, the second he were to become a Christian, it would cost him. It would cost him monetarily, and it would cost him with the media. I mean, even the media that supposedly hates conservatives, they still will give him a platform. All of that goes away if he claims Christ. And I don't know if that's maybe what he's wrestling with. I can imagine it might have something to do with it. But at the same time, you know, we should pray that the Lord opens his eyes, convicts him of his own sin, and that he trusts in Christ to save him from his sins.
That's right. Okay, now, next one by Bill Muhlenberg, serving as a pastor in Australia. And this is, like you said, Paul, a very alliterative title, Woeful Woke Wonders Weakening the West. And say that three times fast.
It reminds me of my old theater days where we would have these warm-ups. That'd be a tough one to say. Woeful Wonders Weakening the West. You say that over and over again. You do that.
Yeah. So what prompted this is an event just happened recently, that a picture that has become iconic, taken on August 14th, 1945. The Japanese had just officially surrendered, bringing this wretched world conflict to a close. So the Germans had already, and the Italians had already closed up and before in May, and now the Japanese in August. And so now, for the first time, everyone can take a deep breath and a sigh. So one young sailor, George Mendonca, gave an impromptu celebratory act by giving a young Jewish dental assistant who was passing by a quick hug and kiss, and the rest is history. So somebody was there, took the picture of it. It was impromptu, it was not staged. There was one take, and that was it. I know you've all seen it, and it was I think it was just outside of Times Square, if I was looking at one of the buildings back there that would indicate that. So now the question that has come up is that there was someone in the Veterans Administration, and this picture, iconic picture, is posted in almost all the VA office buildings and hospitals and whatnot. So one of the administrators of the VA sent out a memo to that this should be removed because it violates all sorts of things that were not really good. So here it is. But in this case, the people that meant government to act very quickly take it down. Fortunately, the secretary of the VA said, no, leave it alone. Everything stays the same the way it is. So the point is that what Bill Muhlenberger is saying in this article is how, so again, time has changed. We just talked about that with the Phyllis Schlafly article. Today's politically charged climate, where simply a look or a comment can send you into the slammer for all sorts of contrived crime, a scene like this would likely never again take place. We are afraid to say anything or do anything for fear of offending the woke wonders who think just about everything is offensive and should be criminalized. In other words, you're invading my space, you're invading my thoughts, you're showing just by your just being in front of me that you're offensive. Of course, this young soldier actually tried to molest this woman, that might be another matter. Real rape and assault is always to be condemned, but he clearly did not try to do this. He said so, and more importantly, she said so. Therefore, an issue should never have been made of the classic photograph and what the sailor had done. Indeed, in my accompanying photo, shows, it's in the article, you'll see it. Years later, both of them signed the famous picture, the man and the woman. Had she really felt that being violated and assaulted, she would not have signed her name to it, but would have taken the sailor to court and lay charges against him. And she, of course, did no such thing. But today, you have to think twice about everything you say and do. Even, and Paul, we just talked about that with the use of the Q word. You have even to double check on what you're thinking about. This is the stifling climate of political correctness, the woke culture, and the cult of victimization that we now have to endure. Big Brother is alive and well. So what does this augur for Western civilization? So I think the spinning off of this particular photo, and someone didn't take it, they interpreted it in context. By the way, this is how history comes into it, is we have to be careful when we're reading back, wherever, however far back we're reading, whether it's in the first century or whether it's in the last century, you know, our interpretation of where we are now and the standards we have back then, good historians don't do that. We can say we don't do that, but we don't, we have to be careful about how we make judgments about that. So good article by Woeful Woke Wonders Awakening the West.
So it is good. It certainly encourages me that because everybody's so hypersensitive, only thing you can really do is just, you know, take one day at a time, trust the Lord, ask him to make you obedient. And if people get offended by that, you know, that's just kind of out of your hands, as far as I'm concerned.
It's more difficult because you sometimes don't know that, quote, you're getting into, you know, someone's space.
My wife, the other day, we were getting shots for our dog, and she was going to pay, and, you know, she got asked a question, and she responded, "Yes, sir." And she immediately, first of all, I'm not a sir. So it's like, well, you know, okay, what are you then? You know, I mean, like, what do you want from me? This person looked like a man. I think is a man. But, you know, it's just that kind of stuff where you can't worry about it. So,
right. Well, it comes up, and fortunately it finds its way into hold on. Yeah, it's in the way of the sometimes in church life where things can get misinterpreted like that. So, yep, you have to be real careful. Okay, number 9 by Kevin DeYoung. This is a book review of Aaron Wren. We just read one of his, I'm going to confer on that one. Now, it's called Anti-Fragile Faith. So this is talking about it. What is we're fragile. Now, so what he's talking about, let's have a faith that's anti-fragile. And so by Aaron Wren, it's life in the negative world, confronting challenges in an anti-Christian culture. That's the book that Aaron has just written. So life in the negative world, confronting challenges in an anti-Christian culture. And in this review, this is the reviews by Kevin DeYoung on Aaron Wren's book, is basically talk about the way life has changed. Now, Wren has given us in the last year or so, maybe 2 years, sort of a way of looking at culture more immediately. Three things that he observes from the 80s, 90s, and then into the 2000s, and then now the period we're in now. And he talks about them in terms of the positive period. And by positive, he's talking about how was Christianity perceived. And then Christianity was still seen as the Christianized view of things. And so that you could speak in certain language, and even in secular culture, most people would understand what you were saying, and it was received somewhat affirmatively. Then he said we moved from that into a neutral period, in which who isn't necessarily right or wrong, but you know, you could take it, you could leave it, and there were different attitudes. But there was a shift that went from the positive to the neutral. We'll let it be, and everyone will be happy. And this is, by the way, that period of time when we had that shift in marriage, where when the Supreme Court decided to allow for, it's all constitutional basis for homosexual marriage, and that it was seen, that's the neutral age. Well, you know, okay, look, we'll just let them do it. If you don't want to do it, it's fine. You're fine. And then we moved into this third realm, and the book is written, How Do We Live in This Negative World? To a negative sense, where that is, that now things have shifted such that the Christianity and the Christianized influence that was so much a part of Western culture, and definitely the context anyway of the United States, that now it was seen negatively. So now you must agree that same-sex marriage is okay. You know, in other words, before it was seen as wrong because of the culture, then it went to neutral. If you have it, fine. If you don't have it, fine. And now it's negative. So therefore, you have to accept whatever we're saying is proper and right. You can't hold to those old-fashioned Christian characters. So this is what the book's about, how to live, then, he says, challenging Christianity in an anti-Christian culture. So we're at that negative world context. So here is Kevin DeYoung's assessment, where he basically does agree with him with that assessment for the most part. He says, I was helped by Wren's observation that Trump and wokeness are two key polarizers at work in resorting evangelicals. At least if you take Trump to be less than voting for Trump, which some evangelicals may do while holding their nose, and more about an aggressive populist, the old rules don't work anymore approach to cultural transformation, then Wren has hit upon an important point. Evangelicalism is being scrambled along these two axes. Are you opposed to wokeness, and are you opposed to Trumpism? If you're relatively straightforward to be opposed to one for the other, or at least not terribly bothered by the other, the difficult space for Christians and churches is when you're opposed to both. So we just talked about that in other articles. So that's where we are in terms of how we make evaluations of things, because now we live in the negative world. So at the heart of life in negative world is practical advice for individual Christians and for Christian institutions as they seek to be faithful in changing cultural landscape. Ren groups his advice into three parts: living personally, leading institutionally, and engaging missionally. And the outline is easy to follow, and advice is down to earth and full of good sense. And then he walks and gives in this review, DeYoung does some guidance of what those three parts are in terms of living, how we live personally, how we live institutionally, and how we engage in the culture at this point in time. So if you really want to understand something of what's happening in our present day with all the wokeness and why people are concerned about photographs like from August 14th of 1945 and what it says now as opposed to what it said then, this will give you some background to you. So obviously, if you read the review, you might as well buy the book and read it as well.
DeYoung says, as he points out, the base of the Republican Party is increasingly made up of non-Christians and post-Christians, gathers its energy from the dissident right and from the growing ranks of barstool conservatives who embrace coarse language and locker room bro culture as much as they oppose left-wing hectoring and nanny state conformity. This presents a challenge for conservative evangelicals who will never vote for Democrats, but who may find themselves in a party that pays lip service to the religious right while becoming more irreligious. Now, this is totally, I think, a legitimate concern as somebody who travels. I mean, I'm in dissident right circles in what I do. And I was just talking about that today. You know, we have angry red-pilled people on the right, and it's really you want to talk about a mission field. It's really a fertile ground, if you will, of people that recognize the wickedness of the left and haven't trusted in Jesus yet, you know. And so that's he's certainly right. And I think the more the society goes off rails and we see the results of rejecting the Christianity that this country was founded on, you know, you're going to see even more splintering, even more, you know, movements. Right. And right now that really is only in the Republican Party from a domestic standpoint. I mean, the Republican Party is not as unified as the Dems. The Republican Party is made up of factions. It just mm-hmm. is what it is right now. It's really mm-hmm. where the only debate is being had is within the Republican Party about, you right. know, what policies are good or not. So
that's a good point. And using Wren's definitions, it could be that we're having, you know, there's a mixture of all three: the positive world, neutral world, and the negative world, all trying to, but yet politically, in terms of what they want at the bottom line, is getting the same thing. It's just that you're going to get their routing differently, but the other side definitely doesn't have it. So here you have to develop some kind of coalition with these three different worlds within the same party.
I agree with that. And that's we're going to see what happens. So,
yep. Okay. Fun. Then we come to number 10 from Trevor Waxy. He says rumblings of revival among Gen X. Notice he says rumblings. He says not something we're still too close to some of those events. Gen X being those that were born the latter part of the 1990s and 1990s and into the present time. So what is a revival? He quotes Tim Keller as in the intensification of the ordinary operation of the work of the Holy Spirit, occurring mainly through the ordinary instituted means of grace, preaching, pastoring, worship, prayer. And he's broad enough that Trevor Wax says that you're not so specific that you can't see some things happening. So he says, I wonder if we're seeing the beginning of a revival among the Gen Z, I said X, I don't know why I said I got that in my brain. Anyway, Gen Z, particularly those who are in college. As I survey the landscape, I see signs of hope and renewal that strike me as unexpected and remarkable. So last year, says Kyle Richter and Patrick Miller reported on renewed interest and enthusiasm of college students in their area and pointed to similar outbreaks of spiritual fire elsewhere. They believe this generation may be primed for spiritual renewal. And then there's, he quotes this, Gen Z is spiritually starved. The disorienting circumstances of the last 3 years, a global pandemic, countless mass shootings, the woke wars, a contested election, rapid inflation, and widespread abuse scandals created a famine of identity, purpose, and belonging. Gen Z is hungry for the very things that empty, desiccated temples of secularism, consumerism, and global digital media cannot provide, but which Jesus can. So that's a good sort of analysis of where, you know, these young people are confused in their confusion. So he says, I pondered about what happened last year with the Asbury notion, when there was the outbreak of the what was a couple week prayer meeting that seemed to be the beginnings of a revival. And so he says, he wondered, well, does it have any lasting value? In the last 2 months, I've spoken at two churches associated with the Salt Company, the City Church in Tallahassee, and also the Cornerstone Church in Ames, Iowa. So they're both in this coalition of the Salt Company. Both churches are teeming with students, passionate, spiritually hungry, mission-minded, on fire for Jesus, as we used to say. Cornerstone Church has experienced tragedy in recent years. In 2020, two young women were shot and killed before the start of a Thursday night service. The church has come through a season of grief, but God has been at work in it and all bringing about evangelistic faithfulness. So there's something happening. It's still early, so we can be more journalists than historians, but at least looking for some of those steps of where is God's spirit intensified in terms of his work. And he lists a number of things of what we're looking for, what signs, like conviction of sin, heightened desire for spiritual discipline, missionary fervor and purpose, ground zero for apologetics, increase in conversions, and the beautified church. And he's not talking about the building, talking about the current, the way folks gather together and meet and worship God as well as fellowship with one another. So I think this very helpful article that gives us at least a peek into something that might be happening, and we trust, we can pray for it, that this generation might be the one that experiences genuine revival that's heaven sent and spirit wrought.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gen Z, I think they kind of know there's just so many inconsistencies out there with the world they're being raised in, and they're being OnlyFans to death, and you know, all of the rampant pornography, you know, people saying that there's no such thing as absolute truth, and you know, and that I think people are rejecting that, and I think the Lord is opening their eyes. I think the more wicked our society is getting, the more people are recognizing that evil exists. Well, if evil exists, then good has to exist, right? I'm not trying to minimize the work of Christ, the work of God, and drawing people to himself, but I think that's part of it for sure.
Exactly. Good. Okay, well, that comes to the end of our top 10 list for the Quilter Report and Weekly Review. This is for March 25th, 2024. Tomorrow, on the 26th, you receive in your inbox, email inbox, the list all hyper linked and ready for you to click on and read through. I think you'll find these moving and helpful. Again, as we like to do, exhort you to share with family, friends, you know, small group leaders, and others. You can forward the whole email with the hyperlinked articles already there. Just, hey, read through these. You might find something helpful. And we just appreciate that we can serve the church by curating these articles for you and expanding our, you know, just place in the world, and that we should also not despair because God is at work. We believe that that's true every generation, no matter what a generation may be, might look like. And so until the next time, we wish and trust that the Lord will anoint you with his blessing and the word by his spirit and give you real power to live for him.